Okay, I think we should resume. Now, hopefully, what I've made clear, although I can never be sure, is that profit is the original primary form of income. We have workers, manual workers, they're producing, but their income is not wages, it's profit. So this brings us to point four. I say producers in the pre-capitalist economy were profit earners. And the fundamental producers in our economy are also profit earners. Profit is a labor income. That's what we've made clear with respect to simple circulation, the early and rude state. We have labor there, but the income of that labor is profit. And what I want to do now is develop and apply this principle to present-day conditions and argue that profit is still a labor income, and the most important labor income in our economy is profit. It's not wages. That the income of the most important producers is profit, not wages. Now, let me point out in this connection that there are different standards of attribution being used in different fields. If we look outside of the realm of the material production, if we look, for example, at history, the first fact that children used to learn in history before the days of political correctness and the total distortion of history was that Columbus discovered America. Now, why would someone say Columbus discovered America rather than give an enumeration of the members of the crew of Columbus? Why not say America was discovered by, yes, Columbus, but also Seaman Giovanni, Captain Giuseppe or whatever? Why not? Or Juan Carlos, why not enumerate all the members of the crew of Columbus's three ships and say they discovered America?
He organized it.
It was his, pardon me?
He was also the fall guy.
It was his project. He conceived the idea. The implicit standard for attributing the discovery of America to one, this one person, Columbus, rather than everyone involved, is that it was his project, he conceived it, and he supplied the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level. It was his in the sense that he supplied the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level. A correct description of the members of the crew and the other people who might have been involved in that way would be that they were the help. It wasn't their discovery. They were helping Columbus in his discovery. He is the one who properly deserves credit. Pardon me? All right, now, there are other such examples. We can also read in history books that Napoleon won the Battle of Austerlitz. This is a major battle in the early 19th century. I think he defeated the armies of Austria, Hungary, and Prussia. Well, again, why say Napoleon won the battle? He probably had tens of thousands of French soldiers with him. Why Napoleon winning the battle rather than Lieutenant Claude and Captain Philippe and Sergeant Jean and so on? Why Napoleon?
Because the attack was his design.
Yeah, again, he supplied the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level. Yet another such example, we may talk of the foreign policy of the United States. When people talk of the foreign policy of the United States, what that means is most of the time, the foreign policy of the president, or possibly the president and plus the Secretary of State and his chief foreign policy advisor, maybe a bare handful of other people. Why is it not the foreign policy of the various employees at the American embassies around the world?
Because the buck stops the president.
Okay, you could say the buck stops at the president. Whose foreign policy is it, actually? Who is implementing what are supposed to be the overall objectives and the broad parameters of the policy? Is this decided at the level of the embassy clerks? No, it's we're saying whose foreign policy it is, again, on the principle of where does the guiding, directing intelligence come from? And we're attributing the overall outcome to whoever is supplying the guiding, directing intelligence, even though tens of thousands of other people may be involved. Now, suppose we were to adopt that same standard in the realm of the production of goods and services. And then we wanted to apply it to, say, the old Standard Oil Company, the Ford Motor Company, and today, say, Microsoft. Who would we have to say are the producers at the highest level? Whose products is it?
Gates.
It would be Gates, Ford, and Rockefeller. Why should we attribute the product to them? Well, they're supplying the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level. So from that point of view, the product would be theirs. And if we attempt to apply this to any firm, I would say in every firm, there is perhaps one or just a handful of people who are occupying this position who are supplying the guiding, directing intelligence to the firm at the highest level. And from the point of view of this principle of attribution, we would say the product is theirs. In some cases, it's much clearer than others. If you look at Microsoft, it's obviously Gates. At Dell Computer, it's Michael Dell. At Intel, maybe there are a handful of people involved. At General Motors, maybe there's half a dozen or a dozen. But it's some small number of people who are providing the guiding, directing intelligence at the highest level, and the product is theirs from this point of view. They produce it. What's the role of the guys on the assembly line?
Labor.
Yeah, they're helping to carry out the plan. They're in the same position as the crew members of Columbus, the soldiers of Napoleon, the clerks at the embassy. They're the help in the realization of the plans of the top executives. Now, the top people may not even necessarily have a formal executive title. In some cases, it's maybe just some key members of the board of directors. It will typically be top executives, some members of the board of directors, possibly some major stockholders who personally aren't even on the board of directors, but who are deciding who's going to be on the board of directors, who's going to be the president of the company, and whatever. It's the people who are making the decisions at the highest level. And the role of the others is they're the help. It's not at all the case that the product is the guys on the assembly line, and then the executives and the stockholders are raking off something that is the creation of the guys on the assembly line. It's the product belongs to the people who are running the company. Now, in the heyday of socialism and the influence of Marx's ideas, there was a popular slogan, which you can see inspired by Adam Smith's notion as to who has the right to the product and the value of the product. The socialists had a slogan, labor's right to the whole produce, or the full value of the produce. And what do you think they meant by that?
That the laborer should reap all the benefit of everything that's
The laborer should have not only his wages, but also the employer's profit, because he's the true producer. But the perspective I'm giving you, if we applied the normal standards of attribution used in history and in current affairs, the normal standard used outside of material production, we would say labor's right to the whole produce is realized every day under capitalism. When does labor receive the right if to the whole produce and the full value of the whole produce? Well, how would you identify where that right is actually implemented in the routine day-to-day operations of a capitalist society?
They can go out and buy
whatever they want. Well, how about when corporations receive their sales proceeds? When the sales proceeds are paid to the firms that are producing them, the sales proceeds are coming into the possession of the people who are running the firms. A labor's right to the whole produce is realized when firms are paid for their products. Now, Adam Smith briefly considered the possibility that profits might be a labor income, and he rejected it after examining it. And what led him to reject it was his recognition of the fact, something which is true, that profits tend to vary in proportion to the capital invested. And we've placed a great deal of stress on that too. Where in the course did we develop and apply the principle that profits tend to be earned in proportion to the capital invested? With the uniformity of profit principle, And Adam Smith had the uniformity of profit principle. I and many others learned it from him. But he thought that the uniformity of profit principle and its implication that profits are earned in proportion to the capital invested, he thought that was incompatible with attributing profits to the labor of the businessman or capitalist. And again, we can turn to a quotation from him. And hopefully someone who hasn't read anything will be kind enough to start reading this paragraph that begins, "The Profits of Stock."
The profits of stock, may perhaps be thought, are only a different name for the wages of a particular sort of labor, the labor's inspection and direction. They are, however, altogether different, are regulated by quite sufficient principles and bear no proportion to the quantity, the hardship, or the ingenuity. Supposed labor of inspection and direction. They are regulated altogether by the value of the stock employed and are greater or smaller proportion to the extent of the stock. Let us suppose, for example, that in some particular place where the common annual profits of manufacturing stock are 10%, there are two different manufacturers, in each of which 20 workmen are employed at a rate of 15 pounds a year each, or at an expense of 300 a year in each manufacturer. Let us suppose, too, that the coarse material annually brought up in the one costs only 700 pounds, while the finer materials in the other cost 7,000. The capital annually employed in one will, in the case, amount only to the 1,000 pounds, whereas that employed in the other will amount to 7,300 pounds. At the rate of 10%, therefore, the undertaker of one will expect a yearly profit of about 100 pounds only, while that of the other will expect about 730 pounds. The thought that profits are so very different, labor of inspection and direction may be either altogether or very nearly the same.
Okay, thank you very much. So he's saying we have the same alleged labor of inspection and direction, but the profits are very different. They conform to the size of the capital invested. And therefore, he denies that profits could be a labor income, just because they vary in proportion to the capital invested. You all see that? Now, Adam Smith also claims that labor produces all wealth. Well, I think the argument he's just developed here contradicts his far more fundamental proposition that labor is the source of all wealth, that it produces all the wealth. Because what would you have to say, suppose we have two physical workers, or three physical workers, three manual workers, and they're all digging holes. and they're all applying the same labor of digging. One guy is using a conventional shovel. Another guy is using a steam shovel. The third guy is scratching at the ground with his fingers and nails. Well, they may all have the very same labor of digging, but what kind of holes will they be expecting? Won't they be expecting very, very different holes that will have a much greater variation than the magnitude of profits in these cases? Well, according to Smith, what will we have to attribute the different size holes to? Because we could say the supposed labor of digging is either altogether or very nearly the same, yet the holes that are dug are so very different. From his point of view, should we attribute the different holes, all three sized holes, to the labor of the guy digging it? If you're following the principle that labor produces all the wealth, then to whom should we attribute the holes? To the labor. The same labor digs very different size holes. In what circumstances? When the means that they're using for digging are very different. So the results of labor vary profoundly with the means employed for producing the results. The results vary with the physical means employed. How does that fundamentally differ than from the profits varying with the capital invested? In all three cases, the products in business are the result of the guiding, directing intelligence of the businessman at the highest level, and the outcomes achieved will vary with the magnitude of the capital invested. Now, in a developed economy, the labor of the profit earners is no longer manual labor very often, or not to any significant degree. In any large-sized business, the labor of the profit earner tends to be a labor of thinking, planning, and decision-making. That becomes its main character. Now, you can think, plan, and make decisions in the one case with respect to a very modest capital, in which case you'll achieve commensurately modest results, or with respect to the employment of a larger capital, in which case you'll achieve greater results. To take a simple example, suppose you devise a better way of marketing shoes. If you only own one shoe store, you can only apply your idea in that one shoe store. If you own 10 such stores, you can apply your idea across the 10 stores. If you have a good idea, in which case do you think you'll make greater profits? We've got 10 stores, but to what should we attribute the profits made in both cases? To your labor of thinking, planning, and decision-making. Even though the results will vary in proportion to the means employed, they're still to be attributed to the human intelligence that guides and directs the means. Now, capital is the means by which a businessman employs helpers and equips them and provisions them with materials and so forth. So we should expect the outcome to vary with the capital because it means he can implement his ideas on a bigger scale. Just think, if Napoleon had a bigger army, wouldn't we expect Napoleon to win more victories or bigger victories? Should we say the only victory that Napoleon can win is when he's engaged in personal hand-to-hand combat? No. Well, why should it be different when we think of the economic realm? There is no reason. The fact is that profit is a labor income. There are two forms of labor income, not just wages, but also profit. And profit is logically prior and more fundamental as a labor income. It's the income of the most important fundamental producers. And the wages are the income of their helpers. So the way I put it here, variation of results with the means employed does not contradict attribution to the intelligence which guides and directs the means. Okay, well, now we're in a position to start developing the substance of Marx's exploitation theory. Now, for a considerable stretch, it may seem to be a theory utterly off the wall, which in reality it is, but the payoff of this will come when you realize just how prevalent this theory is, if you know how to look for it. You have to know how to identify the form in which it's held, and once you do that, you'll see that this theory is still held prevalently, that even though communism has been abandoned in Eastern Europe, and apparently even in the Soviet Union and in mainland China, that still the fundamental Marxist ideas are, with respect to the nature of capitalism, are very little diminished. They're still, they still exert a profound, extremely important influence. All right, well, what the exploitation theory is, it starts off with a framework that I presented, the early and rude state, the development of private property, profits, and then capitalistic circulation, the alleged deduction of profits from wages. The starting point is the idea profits and all incomes other than wages are an unjust, unearned deduction from what properly should be wages. That's the starting point. But the substance of the exploitation theory is an attempt to explain what limits, what determines the exact extent of this deduction. Just how far does the deduction of profit and income other than wages go? What will determine its extent?
Outside of wages?
Yeah, what allegedly determines the extent, according to Marx, in which profits and other, and incomes other than, all incomes other than wages, can be deducted from wages? What determines the limits of the exploitation, how far it goes? Well, that's what we want to deal with. Now, the starting point of Marx's development of the theory is another theory known as the labor theory of value. The labor theory of value. Have any of you ever heard of this? The labor theory of value. This was an extremely influential idea throughout the 19th century and in all branches of Marxism down to the present moment. Marx took over the labor theory of value from the classical economists. Adam Smith propounded it. David Ricardo propounded it. Marx took it over from them and considerably distorted it. Let me illustrate its nature. Yeah, this would be an illustration of the labor theory of value. We have different goods. We have their prices. We have cars, motorcycles, bicycles, skateboards. And let's say a new car costs $20,000, a motorcycle $5,000, a bicycle $500, a skateboard $50. The labor theory of value would argue that there's a simple fundamental explanation for this kind of price relationship, and the basis is the difference in the amount of labor required to produce the different goods. So if, for example, it took altogether 1,000 hours of labor to produce the automobile and 250 hours to produce the motorcycle, well, it's only 1/4 the labor required to produce a motorcycle, and that will explain why the motorcycle has 1/4 the value of the automobile. And if it takes only 1/10 the labor to produce a bicycle as it does to produce a motorcycle, well, then the bicycle will have 1/10 the labor of the motorcycle. And similarly, if the skateboard takes 1/10 the labor of the bicycle, the skateboard will have 1/10 the value of the bicycle. And they would argue that this principle would apply to all goods. So the value of potatoes worth $50, an amount of potatoes worth $50, well, that would be the quantity of potatoes that it took 2.5 hours of labor to produce. The quantity of red paint that sold for $50, well, that would be red paint that took 2.5 hours to produce, and so on for each and every good. Now, the quantity of labor, when the labor theory of value talks about the quantity of labor required to produce something, they're referring to all the labor directly or indirectly necessary. So the labor required to produce a car beyond the labor in the automobile factory would include what? The labor to produce the steel, the labor to mine the iron, and similarly in all of the different components, the labor to grow the rubber trees, to harvest the rubber, etc., etc. So it's all the labor directly or indirectly required. That's supposed to be the relevant labor. Now, the classical economists, particularly Ricardo, they viewed the relative quantity of labor as actually only one of several determinants of the relative value of goods. And in fact, they argued that there are some goods whose value has no connection whatever with the quantity of labor required to produce it. Consider, for example, the price of a Rembrandt painting. Would that have any connection with the number of hours it took Rembrandt to paint the painting?
No.
None at all. Ricardo, in introducing his discussion of the labor theory of value, said there are categories of things totally exempted from this principle, such as rare books and coins, statues and paintings by old masters, anything which could no longer be produced, anything whose production we could not increase by employing additional labor and capital today. If there was something whose production we could not augment, such things, their value was determined by demand and supply, by their own independent scarcity and perceived utility. So that was one major category of exception. But then, even where labor exerted an influence, even where labor was relevant, Ricardo argued that there was a second major principle. Not as powerful as the relative quantity of labor, but nevertheless significant. And that was what he described as the time that is required to bring goods to market, the time required to bring goods to market. And Ricardo argued that this, too, was a permanent influence on the relative value of goods. And let's take a look at cases of this kind. I'm going to reduce the zoom. Is this still visible, I hope?
Yes.
Okay, here we are. We'll deal with different cases. We're assuming in all cases some uniform rate of profit. For the sake of simplicity, a 10% rate of profit. And we'll assume that in all the cases, there's the same total amount of wages paid, $1,000 to pay wages. In our first simplest case, $1,000 of wages are paid 1 year in advance of the product being sold, and the rate of profit is 10%. Okay, what is the selling value of the product? 1.1 times 1,000 is
$1,100.
So here's a product of produced by the payment of $1,000 of wages. And if we assume that the wage rate is the same, if we assume the workers are getting the same wage rate, $1,000 will always buy how much labor? If we have X number of cases in which $1,000 of wages are being paid and the wage rate in all cases is the same, how much labor is being employed in all the cases? You don't have to give me a number of hours of labor, but something that will be true of the amount of labor employed in all cases. well, if there's $1,000 of wages paid, suppose the wage rate in all of these cases was $5 an hour. Then there'd be 200 hours of labor in all the cases. If the wage rate were $1 an hour, how much labor?
A thousand.
So what's in common always is that if the amount of wages is the same and the wage rate is the same, the quantity of labor is the same. The quantity of labor will be the same in all these cases. All right, so now let's assume we have a case. Our second case is, again, there's $1,000 of wages paid, but there's one difference this time, and that is that half the labor is employed in producing materials that will be ready in 1 year, that the other half of the labor will then proceed to work upon, and the final product will be finished a year after that. What will the value of that product have to be if the 10% rate of profit is to be earned over the full period of time in which wages have been paid? It's on the board. We have 500 is laid out now. 500 is paid out in 1 year, so that's a total of 1,000 in wages. And the ultimate final product will be ready 2 years from today. So what will it be worth and why? You can't figure this out?
Because of...
Well, what will it be worth?
$11.55.
It'll be worth $11.55. Why?
Because in order to get the rate of profit, you have to spend it over the 2 years.
How long do you have to wait to recover the first 500 laid out in wages?
1 year.
Well, before the product, the final product is sold. 2 years. You have to wait 2 years on that. Now, if you're going to earn 10% compounded on an outlay of 500 for 2 years, how much will that come to?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's 10% compounded on 500 for 2 years. Yes?
55.
Pardon me?
505.
I'm hearing 55, 505. What's 10% on 500 for 1 year? Okay, so what is the value of the product 1 year later?
$550.
Okay, now, if you're going to earn 10% on that $550, what will be the value of that part of the product 1 year further out?
$55.
Pardon me?
$55 under 5. So $555 plus $55.
$605. Okay, so we have... the payment of 500 of wages today, that's the contribution of today's labor to a product available in 2 years, those 500 of wages will grow to 605, right? Now what about the 500 in wages paid 1 year from today, which will appear in the same product 2 years from today? That's 550, and so if you add 550 and 605, we get 1155. Okay, now.
How do we get 605?
Because 500 compounding at 10% for 2 years is 605. 1.1 squared times 500 is 605. Okay. Well, now just pause on this for a moment. Here we are. We have two products. Both are products of the exact same quantity of labor. Both are employed with the outlay of $1,000. That in both cases is buying the same quantity of labor. Nevertheless, do the products have the same value? One is worth $1,100, the other is worth $1,155. Is this difference something that's going to go away?
No.
It's a requirement. It's implied by what principle that we spent a lot of time working on? Well, something that applies to profits. The uniformity of profit principle. The uniformity of profit principle. To earn the same rate of profit in these two different products, the same compound annual rate of profit, The one product will have to be worth only $1,100, but the other will be worth $1,155. Now, we can take more extreme examples. Suppose in our third example, we have $1,000 of wages paid to workers to lay up in casks raw whiskey, which is going to ferment for 8 years. So we're paying $1,000 of wages today for workers whose product will be available in 8 years. After these workers complete their labor, the raw whiskey just sits there and ages. Well, if this occupation is to be carried on, if this product is to be produced, how much must it be worth to yield a compound 10% annual rate of profit over the 8 year duration of its fermenting or its aging? What do you have? What, in order to invest $1,000 and earn a 10% compound annual rate of return on it over 8 years, how much would the product have to be worth? About $2,000. 1.1 to the eighth power represents approximately a doubling. So now here we are. We have a third product, which is the product of the same quantity of labor as the first two, and its value is almost twice theirs. And what if, in yet another case, we employed $1,000 worth of labor to plant acorns, which in 30 years would represent mature oak trees? How much would the oak trees have to be worth to yield a 10% compound annual rate of profit over a 30-year period?
$17,449.
So that's a staggeringly more valuable product. Now, in these cases of whiskey, oak trees, you might think, okay, they're interesting cases, but they're not very common. What about the great mass of cases? Well, Ricardo pointed out that the elements of this principle, that the period of time is present as a factor, that is operative in every instance in which there is any kind of fixed or durable machinery employed in the production of something. And so we'll take as our last example, we pay workers again $1,000, but this time their product is a machine which will last 10 years. And the machine will get its remuneration as part of the sales proceeds of the product it helps to produce. So we're going to have this machine in operation for 10 years. And over this 10-year period, we have to recover the $1,000 of wages that we paid to build it. Plus, we have to earn the 10% compound annual rate of profit on the average capital outstanding, on the average capital invested. Okay, how much depreciation would we have to take in each year over 10 years to recover our $1,000 investment? Yes?
$100 a year.
All right, $100 a year. Now, what's the average capital outstanding in this machine over the course of 10 years? There's $1,000 at the very beginning. What is there at the end of the last year?
Zero.
Okay, so what would you express the average as?
500.
The average should be 500. So what annual rate of profit would you need to earn 10% on the average capital outstanding? How much profit would you need to earn 10% per year on the average capital outstanding? You'd have to earn 50 of profit per year, right, for 10 years. So that's 500 of profit over the life of the machine. And if you add the 500 of profit to the 1,000 recovery of depreciation, how much product value must the machine bring in to replace its cost and yield 10% on the average capital outstanding? $1,500. 50 plus 100, that's 150 a year for 10 years, that's 1,500. So notice, yet in this yet further case, we have the same quantity of labor that's producing a product whose value is not 1,100, not 1,155, it's 1,500. So notice we have five different cases here in column G. Five products, all of the same quantity of labor, paid the same wages, but is the value of their product equal? Not at all. The value of the product is very unequal. Yes?
On that Scotch one, is that really 2,000 or did you just round it down?
I think there's some rounding, approximately 2,000.
What do you came up with a 17,449, a little bit more than that.
Okay. All right, what is 1.1 to the eighth times 1,000?
Came up with 2,143.
Okay, 2,143. Okay, so that would be the more accurate. Okay. Okay. Well, I'm sure you're right. And as a matter of fact, let me modify the example. That will be the exact answer. Okay, now what principle is accounting for the difference in the value of these products?
Time.
The passage of time. It's Ricardo was very strong on this point. He said all of these cases represent differences in the time required to bring the products to market. And in his correspondence at one point he said he regrets, or if you're going to write his book over again, he would say there are two basic principles determining the relative value of commodities. One was the relative quantity of labor. The other was the period of time required to bring the commodities to market. Now, actually, there's a third principle implied right here. Because what do you think would happen if we changed the assumed rate of profit? What do you think would happen if we worked with a 5% rate of profit rather than 10%, or 20% rather than 10%? Do you think there would be any difference in the relationship between the value of products for these same periods of time?
No.
Yeah,
there would. If we plugged in 20%, the disparities would be greater. With a 20% rate of return, the disparities for the same periods of time would be greater. For example, this first case, instead of being worth $11.55, what would it be worth? What's 20% of 500? 100. And 20% of 600?
120.
Okay, so we'd have two components. One would be 600, the other would be 720.
13.
And this, the value of the product that here is 1155, it would be 1320. And there'd be correspondingly different effects on the other items. So the implication is the rate of profit itself is a determinant of relative value. So we really have three determinants: the relative quantity of labor, the period of time over which profits have to be earned, and also the rate of profit itself. That's a third one. And then there's the further point that there are a significant number of things to which none of these things even apply. There are many things, quite a few, whose relative value is determined simply by demand and supply. Now, there's yet a fourth item, which some of the later classical economists recognized as playing an important role, and this is wage rates. Wage rates. For example, suppose we have two grades of labor. We have skilled labor and unskilled labor. And imagine the unskilled labor is getting $1 an hour, and skilled labor is getting $5 an hour. And we have two products that require 10 hours of labor. One requires 10 hours of unskilled labor at $1, the other requires 10 hours of skilled labor at $5. Are the products going to exchange in proportion to their relative quantities of labor? Will they exchange as one-to-one because they both take the same number of hours of labor?
No.
Which one do you think will be more valuable?
The one with the $5.
The one with $5 an hour. If the two products were produced in the same period of time with the same rate of return, how should their relative values appear? We have one product that is produced with 10 hours of labor at $5 per hour. The other product is produced with 10 hours of labor at $1 per hour. The rate of profit on both is 10%. The period of time in both is the same. Let's say the period of time is a year. Well, how much should the 10 hours of unskilled labor product sell for? $10 at 10%?
$11.
$11. And the other one, $50 at 10%?
$55.
$55. So we have yet a fourth principle that the relative value of products will be governed also by the relative wages. So this is quite a variety of different principles. And the relative quantity of labor appears as just one of four principles. And sometimes none of them apply where the price is determined simply by demand and supply. All right, well, the classical economists, particularly by the time you get to the end of the school with John Stuart Mill, they saw all of these relevant factors. But Marx ignored all of them. Marx ignored all of them, and Marx proceeded as though the only consideration in the prices of commodities was the relative quantity of labor. And that's why I refer to it as the absolutist labor theory of value. It was really a great distortion of the classical economist theory, which allowed for the time factor, implicitly the rate of profit itself, and then on top of that, differences in wage rates, and recognized that there were a substantial number of things not determined by any such principle. Well, Marx ignored all of it. He proceeded as though the only thing governing the relative value of goods was the quantity of labor. And I have extensive quotations from him.
Is there a reason why he ignored all these factors?
Is there a reason?
Why he ignored, obviously ignored all these factors?
Why did he ignore it? Because they were incompatible with the results he wanted to prove. We'll see where you go. If you go along with his assumptions, if you assume that the only thing governing the relative value of things is the quantity of labor, then it doesn't take too many steps to get to where he wants to take you. Let's see what we have here. Okay, I have a slew of quotations from Marx himself, and I'd appreciate it if someone or a few of you would be good enough to read these quotations, starting with the one on the top left column, top of the left-hand column.
Okay, I'll read one.
Okay, thank you.
Goods value or useful article, therefore, has a value only because human labor is in the abstract, has been embodied or interlaced in it. How, then, is the magnitude of this value to be measured? Plainly, by the quantity of the value-creating substance, the labor contained in the article. The quantity of labor, however, is measured by its duration and long labor time in its turn finds its standard in weeks, days, and hours.
Okay, so here he's saying labor is the value-creating substance. It's what gives value. Now, I have other quotations. I would hope someone would read this next one, starting with commodities. Okay, Mr. Severin.
Commodities, therefore, in which equal quantities of labor are embodied, or which can be produced in the same time, have the same value. The value of one commodity is to the value of any other, as the labor time necessary for the production of the one is to that necessary for the production of the other. As values, all commodities are only definite masses of congealed labor time.
Okay, thank you. I catch that last statement as values, all commodities are only definite masses of congealed labor time. What this suggests is that we have pulsating inside commodities some kind of congealed sweat content. And just as physical objects have various types of fields, like maybe there's an electromagnetic field around some things, Marx is more or less suggesting that each and every commodity is emitting some kind of labor sweat field that reacts with the field emitted by others in such a way as to determine their relative value in accordance with the relative quantity of labor congealed in them. Let's take a few more. Who will be kind enough to read these three short paragraphs? Yes, sir.
The equation 20 yards of wind equals one coat, or 20 yards of linen are worth one coat, implies that the same quantity of value substance, congealed labor, is embodied in both. That the two commodities are each cost the same amount of labor, or the same quantity of labor substance. Therefore, 10 pounds of tea equals 40 pounds of coffee. In other words, there is contained in 1 pound of coffee only one fourth as much substance of value, labor, as is contained in 1 pound of tea. In this sense, every commodity is a symbol, since in so far as it is value, it is only the material envelope of the human labor spent upon it.
Okay, thank you very much. Just pause for a moment and reflect on the meaning of that. It doesn't matter what the hell you're producing, just so long as it has the labor. We stuff the labor into the thing, and the product is the material envelope of the labor. And it will automatically have an exchange value in proportion to its labor quantity. I mean, this is sheer, utter nonsense. Now, Marx, he totally ignored all of the things whose value is determined by demand and supply. He totally ignores the time factor, the rate of profit factor. He gave some consideration at some point to the issue of skilled labor versus unskilled labor. But he had a way around that. And what he said was, we shall count every hour of skilled labor as a multiple of unskilled labor. So in our example of the two goods each taking 10 hours of labor, but one takes 10 hours of skilled labor at $5 an hour, the other takes 10 hours of unskilled labor at $1 an hour. Marx's way around that was to say, well, the 10 hours of skilled labor at $5 an hour, well, we'll multiply the $5 an hour times the 10 hours, that's 50, and we'll count that as though it were 50 hours of unskilled labor. So if you do that, then you come out with the answer. These two products are both exchanging in proportion to the labor time. The more expensive one has 50 hours, the less expensive one has 10. But it's simply not true that it has 50 hours, it has 10 hours. It's 10 hours of skilled labor. So he just got around that. One of his critics pointed out, it's like a railway company saying, we will charge you 1 cent per mile, except when we go through mountain country, then each mile counts as 2 miles. So it's changing the terms. It's not a legitimate procedure. Okay, but let's go along with these nonsensical assumptions. Let's assume that the only thing determining the value of anything was the number of hours of labor required to produce it. And we'll see where this is going to take us. We'll do this to see what Marx can do with it. All right, the first implication is, this is point two now, it implies that all value added, all the value added at any stage of production, the sum of the profits and the wages together, all value added is proportionate to the fresh labor added. Why? Well, if nothing is operative but the quantity of labor, let's suppose we have a product, we have some materials produced, they've required a certain number of hours of labor. Let's say our starting point is previously produced means of production that are themselves the products of 48 hours of labor. Let's say we have some raw cotton. This is Marx's own example. Suppose we have raw cotton that was produced with 40 hours of labor. and the cotton mill, the depreciation on the cotton mill represents the using up of eight of the hours of labor required to produce the mill. So how many hours of labor are we beginning with in the means of production that we're going to use to produce our product, cotton yarn?
Did you say 100 hours possibly?
No, that's 40 hours of labor to produce a quantity of raw cotton.
Okay, 48 hours.
Pardon me?
48 hours.
Okay, there's 48 hours. Now, how much labor is going to be in the cotton yarn that results from the raw cotton and the milling equipment that processes the raw cotton? How many hours of labor would be in the cotton yarn to the extent that it comes from raw cotton and the plant and equipment in the cotton mill?
48.
Yes?
48.
48 hours. Well, now, here we are. The raw cotton and the depreciation had a certain value corresponding to the 48 hours of labor, right? And now there's 48 hours of labor passed forward into the cotton yarn. How much would the cotton yarn be worth?
96.
Pardon me?
96.
48. No, we start off, we use up 48 hours. We use up means of production that required 48 hours of labor to produce. They're used up. And now instead, we have the resulting product. How many hours of labor pass forward into the product? 48 hours of labor. If I ask you how many hours of labor went into this final product, I tell you 48 went into the materials and the used up equipment. So at least how much must be in the final product?
48.
Okay, but now notice, is there any basis for any value added here? If the product took the same number of hours of labor as the used up means of production, could the product be worth any more than the used up means of production?
No.
Not according to Marx. To take another example, or maybe that would elaborate this example. Suppose we were producing cotton yarn in a 100% automated plant. So at one end, there's the receiving docks, and the raw cotton is dumped at the receiving docks, and now machinery yanks the raw cotton into the mill, and then in order to set this going, we have one guy who passes by at 9 a.m. in the morning. He pushes one button with his pinky. And then the machinery proceeds to take all of the raw cotton from the receiving dock, bring it into the plant, put it onto the conveyor belts where it goes through the machines, and further machines are processing it. And then at the end of the day, it's all neatly stacked up on the shipping docks. How much more valuable would the cotton product on the shipping dock be than the raw cotton on the receiving dock? Together with the allowance for used up plant and equipment. How much labor is in the starting point and the ending point?
No labor.
Both products have exactly the same labor. If we have materials and used up machinery, which take 48 hours of labor to produce, and we get a product resulting from them, that product then has those 48 hours of labor. And would there be anything to make the product more valuable than the means of production used up to produce it? No. There'd be no gain in value. Well, what's required, according to Marx's theory, for one product to be more valuable than another? For the product of means of production to be more valuable than those means of production? Fresh labor, the addition of fresh additional labor. The only reason that one product can be worth $60 and another product only $48 is that the product worth $60 contains more labor than the one worth than the product worth only $48. Well, let's make a simple assumption about monetary values. let's assume that for every hour of congealed labor, there is $1 of product value. Show me an hour of congealed labor, or better, show Marx an hour of congealed labor, and he'll show you $1 of product value. So here we are, we have raw cotton, the product of 40 hours of labor, its monetary value is $40. And we have plant and equipment. The plant and equipment might be worth $1 million, reflecting 1 million hours of labor performed in building it. But if that plant and equipment is sufficient to process 1 million batches of raw cotton, then how much of that labor is expended? Let the plant be produced by 8 million hours of labor. The plant took 8 million hours of labor. It's worth $8 million, but it's sufficient to process 1 million batches of raw cotton. How many hours of labor are used up from the plant and equipment in processing this one batch? What is 1/1 millionth of 8 million? Eight. Okay, so there's 8 hours of labor coming from the plant and equipment. And so what do we know the value of the product is going to be, at least according to Marx?
Eight
for the plant and equipment, and 40 for the raw material. So it's 48. Now, what would be required for the value of the cotton yarn to be $60 rather than just 48? Yeah, if there was some guy in the mill who was putting in a 12-hour day to process the raw cotton by means of the aid of the plant and equipment, and then we would have the cotton yarn that's loaded onto the shipping dock. That cotton yarn would be the product altogether of 60 hours of labor in total. And so it would be worth $60. Now, notice what is the value added here? What's the monetary value added? There's $12 of value added. The product is worth $60. The used up material means the production were worth only $48. And what accounts for the value added is this addition of 12 hours of fresh labor. Now, this conclusion, it follows as a matter of principle. If it were true that the only thing which explains the monetary value of something were the number of hours of labor congealed in it, the only way that a product could be more valuable than the means of production used up to produce it would be if and to the extent the product contained more labor than those means of production. Well, where does that happen? What makes it possible, as a regular routine occurrence, for a product to contain more labor than the material means of production used up to produce it? The addition of fresh labor. Fresh labor is employed at each stage of production. Now, here we are, if the product is worth $60, because it contains 60 hours of labor, and the used up materials and depreciation were worth $48, because they contained only 48 hours of labor, well, what then is the value, the monetary value added? Yes?
$12.
We have $12 of value added, corresponding to the addition of 12 hours of labor. Now, these $12 of value added, what does that represent in terms of incomes? If you looked at a firm's income statement, suppose they told you, our sales proceeds for this item are $60. Our cost on account of depreciation and used up materials is $48. What would the $12 difference represent? Well, profit is part of it. Is there anything else? Well, that's technically correct, but what does that mean in a meaningful context? What element of cost have we omitted?
Machine.
That's the depreciation. We have pardon me?
You did the additional $12 of wages.
Are these $12 wages?
You said 48.
No, I said 48 is the number of hours of labor that was required to produce the materials and the part of the plant used up. And they have a monetary value of $48. Did I say anything about the wages in the cotton mill?
I said they were $1 an hour.
I said for every hour of labor expended to produce a product, there's a dollar of product value. So we have $48 that's expended for what? $48 buys what? It buys raw cotton worth $40, and $8 buys one one-millionth of the plant and equipment, which took eight million hours to construct. So have we said anything about the wages paid in the production of the cotton yarn?
No.
No, we have not. Now, this $60, the value of the yarn, the value of the cotton yarn is $60. The $48 is the value of the materials and the depreciation. What element of cost is missing?
Wages.
We have sales minus all of the costs with the exception of wages. We have sales minus costs exclusive of wages. Well, what do you get if you subtract from sales costs minus wages? What, maybe someone could go to the board and work out what do we get when we subtract from sales costs minus wages? Mr. Say, would you be willing to do that? Just write sales. Okay, and below it, write minus costs minus wages. Now, on one line, on the same line, minus costs minus wages. Now, if you want to show minusing costs minus wages as one item, okay, exactly, you need to put in can you all see he has parentheses? You need to darken the one at the end, I think. Yeah, make it a little darker. Now, it's not cost plus wages, but cost minus wages.
Okay.
Sales minus cost minus wages. Now, draw a line underneath. And what does that reduce to? Pardon me?
Profits plus wages.
Sales minus costs alone is profit, right?
Yeah.
But what is minus minus wages?
Plus
wages. Plus wages. So notice the difference between the value of a product and the value of the material means of production used up to produce it is the sum of profits and wages together. So when Marx, that's fine, thank you very much. When Marx argues that fresh labor adds all value, when he says fresh labor adds all value, what he's also implying is that the addition of fresh labor is responsible for the sum of profits and wages together. The addition of fresh labor is what accounts for the addition of wages and profits together. That's his next key step. And I say here under point two, thus fresh labor allegedly adds all value, the sum of profits and wages. The sum of profits and wages. Now I also say corresponding Marxian terminology of constant and variable capital. Ms. Fox used the expression variable capital. Variable capital is the way Marx describes the part of the capital used to pay wages. The other part of the capital, the part of the capital used to buy materials and machinery and anything else other than fresh labor, he calls constant capital. Now, the reason he uses that terminology is the part of the capital that he calls constant, he means to say, is constant in value. The raw cotton, the depreciation, do they add any value? They pass over into the product at an unchanged constant value. What is the part of the capital that's responsible for the whole addition of value?
The labor.
The labor part,
the part that pays wages. So he calls that the variable capital. It's the value-creating part of the capital. Okay, now we need to deal with his next question, and that is, what will determine the breakdown of the value allegedly all added just by fresh labor? What's going to determine how much of that is going to go to the workers as wages and how much to the capitalist exploiters as profits? He's got it set up already, as we have seen, that fresh labor adds all value. It adds the profits and wages together. Some part of this fresh value, this new and additional value allegedly created just by fresh labor, some part goes to the workers as wages, the rest goes to the capitalists as profit. And Marx is attempting now to provide an explanation how much of the value added by fresh labor goes to the capitalists, how much goes to the wage earners. Does anyone know what his explanation is? Pardon me?
He divides the profits by wages.
No, he doesn't divide profits by wages. That's not going to be the explanation. You might say profits over wages equals something, but that's not explaining what part goes to the one and to the other. Well, he calls upon the labor theory of value once again. Have any of you ever heard the expression, under capitalism, labor is treated as a commodity, or it shouldn't be treated as a commodity? Have you heard any references to labor in connection with commodity status?
No.
Pardon me?
No. Sure.
Who, has anyone here heard it? Okay, at least one person. What have you heard?
It's actually something running rampant in the consulting world.
Pardon me?
In the consulting business that we work in, instead of being a top producer, they've looked at our service as a simply, which is a labor, which is just a commodity, something that can be bought and sold at by a price for.
Okay. All right. Well, that would be a partial connect. What Marx meant and his followers when they were complaining that under capitalism, labor is just another commodity, or it shouldn't be that way, but it is. They held that the value of labor is governed by the labor theory of value. It's governed by the universal law of this alleged universal law of commodity value formation. So they argued that the value of labor itself is determined in exactly the same way as the value of the raw cotton, as the value of shoes, or anything else. Well, what does that mean? What's supposed to determine the value of labor? Well, allegedly, the quantity of labor required to produce the labor. Now, you might wonder, what does that mean, the quantity of labor required to produce the labor? Well, what it ends up meaning is the quantity of labor required to produce the wage earner's necessities, the quantity of labor required to produce the goods and services minimally essential to keeping him alive and able to work. That's how the Marxists regard the quantity of labor required to produce labor. And let me...
Would that be minimum subsistence?
Minimum subsistence. The quantity of labor required to produce the wage earner's minimum subsistence. And let's again find some quotations from Marx. And again, I'd like a volunteer to start off with this passage, the value of labor power. Okay, yes, Mr. Noble.
The value of labor power resolves itself into the value of a definite quantity of...
No, up at the top.
Where?
Yeah. The first value of labor power.
Oh, the one on top.
Yeah.
The value of labor power is determined, as in the case of every other commodity, by the labor time necessary for the production and consequently also the production of the special article. So far as it has value, it represents no more than a definite quantity of the average labor of society incorporated in it. Labor power exists only as a capacity or power of the living individual. Its production consequently presupposes its existence given the individual That's a little better.
Okay.
Gives the individual the production of labor power consists in his reproduction of himself or his maintenance. For his maintenance, he requires a given quantity of the means of substance. Therefore, the labor time requisite for the production of labor power reduces itself to that necessary for the production of those means of subsistence. In other words, the value of labor power is the value of the means of subsistence necessary for the maintenance of the laborer.
Okay, and now, thank you very much. If someone would read this next paragraph, where he elaborates the idea. Okay, Ms. Fox.
The value of labor power resolves itself into the value of a definite quantity of means of
subsistence.
It therefore varies with the value of these means or with the quantity of labor requisite for their production.
Continue, please.
Some of the means of subsistence, such as food and fuel, are consumed daily, and a fresh supply must be provided daily. Others, such as clothes and furniture, last for longer periods and require to be replaced only at longer intervals. One article must be bought or paid for daily, another weekly, another quarterly, and so on. But in whatever way the sum total of these outlays may be spread over the year, they must be covered by the average income, taking one day with another. If the total of the commodities required daily for the production of labor power equal A, and those required weekly equal B, and those required quarterly equal C, and so on, the daily average of these commodities equal 365A plus 52B plus 4C plus hand C divided by 365. Suppose that in this mass of commodities requisite for the average day, there are embodied 6 hours of social labor, then there is incorporated daily in labor power half a day's average social labor. In other words, half a day's labor is requisite for daily production of labor power. This quantity of labor forms the value of a day's labor power, or the value of the labor power daily reproduced. If half a day's average social labor is incorporated in 3 shillings, then 3 shillings is the price corresponding to the value of a day's labor power. If its owner, viz. The wage earner, therefore offers it for sale at 3 shillings a day, its selling price is equal to its value. And according to our supposition, our friend Moneybags, who is intent upon converting his 3 shillings into capital, pays this value.
Okay, thank you very much. So here we're told, he's assuming that the quantity of labor required on an average basis to produce the wage earner's necessities is 6 hours. 6 hours will produce the quantity of food, fuel, furniture, whatever else might be required to enable the worker to perform his work. The worker consumes necessities produced in 6 hours and he's able to perform his work. How many hours of labor is he able to perform? How many hours of labor have we been assuming? Well, how about 12 hours? Marx's argument is the worker has the ability to perform 12 hours of labor, but he has that ability on the basis of consuming necessities which can be produced in a shorter time, such as 6 hours. And it's this that he uses as his basis of explaining profits. According to Marx, the capitalists, in the absence of government intervention, if they were not constrained by government intervention coupled with the labor unions, what wages would a capitalist pay?
The lowest possible amount.
Whatever the market would allow.
And the lowest would have to be, if they don't want the workers to die of starvation, if they want them to stick around and continue to work,
minimum subsistence.
According to Marx, the wages that are paid under capitalism are always going to be minimum subsistence. But on the basis of getting minimum subsistence wages, the worker is physically able to work more hours of labor than are required to produce his necessities. Now Marx calls this proposition that the wage earners are just going to be paid minimum subsistence. That's his version of the so-called iron law of wages. So if we back up to our question, what's determining the breakup, the allocation of this $12 of value added by the performance of 12 hours of labor, well, what's determining how much of the $12 goes to the wage earner as wages? The number of hours of labor required to produce his necessities. And if those necessities can be produced in just 6 hours, then how much will the worker be paid for his 12 hours of labor?
$6.
But how many hours of labor does he add to the capitalist materials and depreciation?
12 hours.
And how many dollars of value does he add?
$12.
So notice, here we are. The worker is able to work 12 hours. In 12 hours, he adds 12 hours of labor to the materials and depreciation. He's adding $12 of value to the value of the materials and depreciation. And how much is he paid?
$6.
Why?
Because
that's what corresponds to the labor required to produce his minimum necessities. So according to Marx, well, the way I put it here, in point C, the division of the value added between wages and profits, says Marx, is determined by the fact that the 12 hours of fresh labor can be purchased at a price representing the number of hours of labor required to produce those 12 hours. If, to use Marx's own example, the worker can work for 12 hours on the basis of necessities which require only 6 hours to produce, then, says Marx, he is paid a wage of only $6. Thus, the capitalist acquires 12 labor hours and the value added by 12 hours at a price corresponding to only 6 hours. Thus, profits are made, says Marx, by the systematic underpayment of labor. The capitalist buys a full labor day, 12 hours, but pays only for the hours required to produce the worker's necessities. The hours the worker works over and above what are required to produce his necessities represent, allegedly, unpaid, quote, surplus labor time. Profits relative to wages, surplus value relative to variable capital, are both expressions for the rate of exploitation. And here we can see the formula. The rate of exploitation can be expressed in a variety of ways. Simply profits over wages. Or, if we want to now apply Marx's own terminology, surplus value over variable capital. The surplus value is his catch-all expression for profits, interest, land rent. It's like a broader concept of profit. And variable capital is simply really still wages. But what governs that relationship? Well, what's governing it is supposedly the relationship between surplus labor time and necessary labor time. And let us try to quantitatively illustrate this. All right, well, I quote him. Hopefully, if you haven't done the readings, you'll do them on page 608. He's quoted his exposition of the doctrine. But I want to work it out in some arithmetical detail. All right, here we are. Let's... to diminish this slightly. I'm going to have to reduce it a little bit more. Is this visible in the back? Can you see this, Mr. Cunningham?
Yes, 12
hours. Okay. Here we are. His formula is the pardon me? Yeah, let's see if I can.
Yes.
Okay, this is a little bit better. All right, yeah, this is the best way. We have the rate of exploitation. The rate of exploitation is profits over wages, or equivalently, a surplus value over variable capital. All right, here we are. We have $6 of profit and $6 of wages. So the rate of exploitation is 100%. Now, what is it that underlies this? What makes this possible? The $6 of profit is $6 of surplus value. Well, the ultimate explanation, according to him, is the relationship between surplus labor time and necessary labor time. What does he mean by necessary labor time? What's the necessary labor time?
Minimum subsistence.
Pardon me?
Minimum subsistence hours.
It's the time required to produce the worker's minimum subsistence. The time required to produce those goods which the worker has to consume in order to put in his normal working day. Now, we're assuming that the necessary labor time is 6 hours. So what does that mean about the wage the worker will have to be paid?
$6.
$6, that enables him to buy the necessities produced in 6 hours. Well, if the worker works not 6 hours, but 12 hours, if 12 hours is the working day, what will be the surplus labor time, the time the worker works over and above the time required to produce his necessities?
6 hours.
6 hours, so there'll be surplus labor time of 6 hours. He's working altogether 12 hours. 6 hours is required to produce his necessities. There's a further 6 hours that represents, according to Marx, surplus unpaid labor time, and that's the source of profit. See, the worker's 12 hours adds $12 in value to the materials and depreciation. How much is he paid of the $12 that he adds? $6, corresponding to how much he has to pay for his necessities. So what's left for profit?
$6.
So the foundation of profit, according to Marx, is surplus labor time. Now, have any of you ever heard the expression wage slavery?
Yes.
Okay, that comes from Marx and his followers, and they meant it literally. They thought that the wage earner, the position of the wage earner, is essentially that of a slave. Why? Well, what is the basis of gain of a slave owner? How does a slave owner gain by virtue of owning a slave? Now, the slave produces, but can the master simply take everything that the slave produces and leave it at that? What will happen if he does that?
No, he has to give him minimum subsistence.
Yeah. If he wants the slave to stay alive and perform the next day, he has to allow the slave to consume enough to keep alive, to stay alive, and in sufficient health to work. So in that light, what is the gain of the slave owner?
Production minus that cost?
Yeah, it's the fact that the slave is able to produce more than his subsistence. Well, that's the basis of the gain of a slave owner. And according to Marx, the source of profits is the same thing. According to Marx and his followers, the wage earners of capitalism are in the same status as slaves. They're supposedly free, they have, but it's argued that that's only in form and appearance. You may recall the discussion, the quotation from Galbraith. He believes that. The southern slave owners used to claim that against the northern factory owners. And this is a regular doctrine of the communists. You don't have to worry, according to them, about a country going communist and then having slave labor camps. Why not? Well, we're already slaves. So they'll just give the slaves a better deal. Now, and it's on this basis that you have lines in the Communist Manifesto saying all of human history is the record of one continuous class struggle carried on in the ancient world between master and slave, in the Middle Ages between lord and serf, and in modern times between capitalist and wage earner. In their view, the capitalists are profiting on the same basis as the slave and serf owners. namely the capacity of the workers to produce more than their own subsistence. Now let's quickly see some of the implications of the exploitation theory. This is in A, all progress allegedly passes the workers by. Why? Well, let's say we have progress in the production of things that remain out of their reach. We bring down the price of luxury yachts. We bring down the price of caviar and prime sirloin steak. What's that going to do for the wage earners? Nothing. They can't afford these things anyway. All right, now suppose we have progress in the things that they buy. Like they're buying cheap black bread. And now we improve farming technology and better equipment in agriculture. So we can produce the items of the workers' diet in less time than it used to take. It takes less labor to produce the wage earners' necessities, and with the result that their prices will come down. Will this be of any benefit to the wage earners?
Because
the capitalists will very quickly cut their wages. They're not in a position to benefit from economic progress. Just remember, according to Marx, wages are determined by the quantity of labor required to produce the workers' necessities. So what happens if we start out, it takes 6 hours to produce the workers' necessities, but now with economic progress, it only takes 3 hours.
And they're paying $3.
Then the wages will be cut from $6 to $3. Now, has anyone ever heard the line from Das Kapital, the workers are men without a country, they have nothing to lose but their chains?
No.
Well, now you're hearing it, and this is why. It's thought they have nothing to gain. Whatever progress occurs will just pass them by, and their wages will be reduced. It's an implication of these ideas that if we had full-bodied capitalism, there'd be a set of financial statistics that does not presently appear. Under full-bodied capitalism, allegedly alongside the quotations from the stock exchange, the commodities markets, and so on, there'd be another set of statistics, and that would be the price of wage earners' necessities. The price of the cheapest black bread, mud cabin rentals, the price of loincloths. And the capitalists would be looking at these prices, and any time things occurred which brought them down, they would speedily reduce wages. So the wage earners could just never get ahead. They could not make any economic progress. But then, as I say in point B, things are supposed to get still worse. The doctrine of the progressive impoverishment of the masses. And so not only are the workers starting out at subsistence, things go downhill from there. Why? Well, there's supposedly two reasons. One is the capitalists are more calculatingly greedy than earlier exploiters. The old feudal nobility, they were restrained by custom and tradition. They weren't in it for the last ounce of profit, so they would allow feast days and holidays and whatever. They would once in a while act as sports and give the serfs a day off. But the capitalists are in it to maximize profit. And then over and above that, there's something that drives them to make conditions worse, and this is the doctrine of a tendency toward a fall in the rate of profit. This was a popular Marxist doctrine, and he inferred a tendency toward a falling rate of profit from the effects of capital accumulation. The capitalists would allegedly be saving and investing some substantial part of their profits, and most of the saved and reinvested profits, he argued, would take the form of additions to constant capital, capital in the form of buildings, machinery, raw materials, not in the form of additional demand for labor. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem is that the whole profit is earned only on the variable capital. And now the effect would be that if we have a given rate of exploitation and a given amount of variable capital, we have to spread the same amount of profit over a bigger total amount of capital. I give an illustration here. Imagine initially we had 100 of capital, equal to 50 of variable capital and 50 of constant capital. And the rate of exploitation is initially 100%. Well, then how much is surplus value?
50.
And the rate of profit would be 50 over 100. Well, if the capitalists are saving and reinvesting, and now we end up with 200 of capital, but all of the growth is in constant capital, well, now we have still 50 of variable capital and 150 of constant capital. If the rate of exploitation is still just 100%, what's the rate of profit? What's 50 over 200? Well, only 25%. So the rate of profit is falling. Now you might say, okay, 25%, that's still a good rate. But as it gets lower and lower, the capitalists will be under increasing pressure to boost the rate of exploitation to maintain the rate of profit. Well, how are they going to boost the rate of exploitation? Well, one way is increase the working day. The capitalists see their rate of profit is falling, and they notice that up to now, the workers leave the mills after putting in their 12 hours, and they're not going home immediately to their thatched huts and falling on the mattress to reinvigorate themselves for the next day's work. These buzzards may be stopping off at the local pub, maybe they're frolicking around in the on the commons, playing some kind of games, and the capitalist food that they're buying with the wages he pays them, it's being wasted in frivolous enjoyment instead of motion turning his equipment. So what will the capitalist do?
Day.
He'll cut the wages, so maybe they'll now have to work 18 hours a day to earn minimum subsistence. If he can do that, what's the effect on surplus value and the rate of exploitation?
It increases.
Okay, now we'll have 12 hours of surplus value versus 6 hours of necessary labor time, and the rate of exploitation will be 200%. And then, very similarly, the capitalist will be noting when the worker gets home, he's greeted by his wife and two replacement children. And they've been spending their time in such frivolous nonsense as reading nursery rhymes. And they've been engaged in this foolishness on the foundation of the wages the capitalist pays the worker. And they have body motion and so on. They could do some useful work in the mills. So the capitalist will cut the wages of the adult male worker further, requiring the assistance of all ambulatory family members. They have to then work in the mills. So we have child labor and the labor of women for the first time. That was a major Marxist complaint. This will step up the rate of exploitation. And then on top of all this, the capitalist will be bringing about a generalized speed-up. If they can have a speed-up of work, what will that do to the amount of time required to produce the wage earner's necessities?
It reduces.
It reduces that. That makes possible more surplus value. And then the capitalist will also be studying the worker's diet. And they may observe in Britain, the workers are eating wheat bread. In Ireland, they're eating potatoes. In the Orient, they're getting by on rice. But potatoes and rice are a lot cheaper than wheat, so the capitalist will try to change the diet. You know, like a chicken farmer is calculating on the most economical feed. Allegedly, that's what the capitalist will be doing. So this is a catalog of horrors. Now, I notice some of you laughing, and it deserves a lot of laughter. But you have to stop and think how seriously this is all taken. Because I venture to say many of you believe this. Not about the actual prevailing conditions. But what would happen if the minimum wage law were appealed, the pro-labor union legislation were appealed, the maximum hours laws were appealed, and the child labor laws were appealed? What, if not you, at least many people you know, what do they think would happen? Pardon me?
Abuses.
That exactly these conditions would develop. You see, Marx is thought to be laughable from one perspective, from the actual prevailing conditions that we live in, but also thought to be dead on the money, not under the present system, but under laissez-faire capitalism. if the government did nothing, if we didn't have government intervention, then it's widely believed that Marx would really be right, and that he was accurate, not for today, but for the conditions of the mid-19th century. And what made him accurate was not the simple time period, but the fact that then we did have laissez-faire. People's views on economic history are entirely governed by these ideas. Why were conditions so bad in the past? They were bad. Real wages were miserably low, hours were terrible, conditions were horrible, there was child labor. But why was there all of this? What's the usual explanation?
Capitalist greed.
The capitalists had unrestrained greed. The unions weren't there to stop them, the government wasn't there to stop them, so they wreaked havoc. That's the explanation. And then what brought about improvement?
Government.
The government intervention. Now, this is exactly the way that the immense majority of people understand modern economic history, and I think the whole so-called liberal program of the last 150 years or so can be understood in the light of this set of ideas. Just think, why do we have laws to limit the working day?
To
prevent the dirty capitalists from lengthening the working day to the maximum humanly endurable. And at whose expense are these laws supposed to be? Who pays for them? Only the capitalists. Is there any thought to be any negative impact on the workers?
No.
No, it's thought, well, if we shorten the working day, all we're doing is reducing surplus value. We're not doing anything to the wage earner's standard of living. The wage earner is still going to get paid just what he would have been paid. The only people who are going to suffer are the capitalists. We don't give a damn about them anyway. They'll just have less surplus value, less profit. Similarly, abolishing child labor. At whose expense is that?
Capitalists.
The dirty capitalists. The wage earners will get as good wages as before, only their children will now go to school. The capitalist surplus value will be cut. The same thing with improving conditions. And what about with the unions, minimum wage laws? How is that perceived as operating? At the expense of the capitalists, it's thought to be, if we have minimum wage and union legislation, it's conceived of as working in the same way as if the necessary labor time were greater. Instead of the necessary labor time being 6 hours, the law can make the necessary labor time the equivalent of 7 hours. And the capitalists now just have to pay it. Is there any negative effect on the workers?
No.
It's at the expense of surplus labor time, surplus value. So the whole way that people understand the workings of labor and social legislation, it's point for point in accord with this theory. And then finally, if you think of the progressive income tax, the inheritance tax, the welfare state spending, what is the justification for all of this? Well, the underlying idea is the government will tax the dirty capitalist exploiters, just take back some of their ill-gotten loot, and spend the money for the benefit of the victims, the ordinary wage earners. Well, how does this differ from the campaign platform of the typical Democrat? And half the Republicans, too, who are in competition. They're all Marxists. Now, I'm not saying that they're advocating. Please hear me out on this. I don't want to say anyone telling, reporting me as saying, I think the Democrats are advocating communism or the violent overthrow of the U.S. government. I don't say that. I don't even say they're advocating socialism. They're Marxists in their understanding of capitalism. They're Marxists as far as they think they understand how capitalism works. There, they really are Marxists. And this theory just goes unchallenged. Ignoramuses repeat it every day, day in and day out, and it's straight out of Marx. Okay, on that note, I wish you all a happy Thanksgiving, and I'm glad you got the punchline. Okay.
Marxist.